this time, Mel, K2KEY, and Dick, K2RIW, are going to open a thing called the Technical Man. It's a gathering of the amateur radio clan. We help each other understand the 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. How do these antennas and transmission lines and transmitters and receivers and propagation and all this other jazz, how does it all work? The price is right. We don't offer a free consulting service, but we do offer a live verbal exchange of information. Sometimes the exchange goes on a little bit too long and gets a little bit too deep. It's never perfect. You can never please everybody, but we try. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question. You do have a question or a comment for the net. So give me your call letters and name, and we'll start writing you down in that order. K2RIW listening.
November WA2 Romeo Alpha Sierra. Jeff, yes.
November 2 Echo Oscar, yes.
So far we've got Wesley, Jeff, and Rich in that order. Anyone else?
Hey, this is K2KEY. May I say something, Dick, before we start?
Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay, I got some nice positive emails that we stick to the format that we started last week. Spend a brief time answering everybody's questions, and if it needs more in-depth explanation, we'll come back to it. Is that agreeable? Over.
Mel, are you telling me that those people had the nerve to say that RIW is long-winded and you got to throttle that guy back a little bit? Is that what they were saying, Mel? That was a joke. Go ahead, back to you, Mel.
Absolutely not. Compliments. Kudos to you for your in-depth explanation on many, many of the subjects that we have covered. However, they would like us to make sure that we do cover everybody. There are a number of people have said that in the past they have called in and they never got their question answered. But most likely, as you have seen in the past, that we have called them, but it was quite late on, maybe after 11 o'clock, and they have already gone QRT. So if we cover everybody's questions as briefly as possible, short the reasonable time, I think we can always get everybody in and get back to, if I could say it needed further explanation. Over.
Yeah, I think I understand, and I think I agree that try to get to each person first and then come back to them when it comes to longer questions requiring longer information. Also, everyone should remember that when you sign in, and if for a whole bunch of reasons we don't get to you, you will automatically be number one the men next week, no matter when you sign in the next week. You'll go to the head of the line, if you know what I mean. So if we don't get to you some particular week because of confusion, long-windedness, or whatever, don't despair. Your question will come up after the week after. I wonder if we've got Paul on frequency tonight, WS2N and KE2EJ, or either of you guys around? How about that? Only half the staff is there, Mel. It's just you and me. These guys are later showing up. Okay. Wesley, I know you're assembling one hell of a measurement laboratory there in Queens, in which you're going to be digging into some pretty heavy physics experiments, trying to understand some of the things that are confusing people. Machines that have excess energy and high voltage phenomena. I believe you're a significant enthusiast of the work of Nikola Tesla. And so I'm only slightly joking when I say sometime in the future, Wesley, will there be a method in Queens for people to send power to each other without using wires? As I said, I'm only half joking when I say that. N2XJN, K2RIW. You got it, Wesley.
Thank you very much, Dick. N2XJN. Well, I would like to discuss today ferroresonance. Ferroresonance, let me jump for a moment. Okay. Thermal resonance is a complex electrical phenomenon that is identified since 1920s and remains just a little bit understood today. It is characterized by sudden onset of very high sustained overvoltages, and these high levels of harmonic distortions that appears on the circuits could actually damage the circuits. Thermal resonance has been also known as responsible for equipment damage and protection manufacturers. It is hard to analyze, in part because it does not occur regularly and predictably, and is responsible for a number of failures of power supplies, high voltage transformers. Tesla in his Tesla in his patent that he delivered to J.P. Morgan, and when he thought that he is able to produce the excess of the energy, he actually described thermal resonance as the major factor for this device to work. And why is that important? Well, whether you have a three phases or you have a one phase from your grid, when you have not enough load, the impedance and capacitance of that particular transformer that you have might actually create the resonance. Now, what is very interesting about it is that resonance actually is within the molecular structure of the ferrites. That's one of the things that the people think is happening over there. I wonder what you are able to say in this area. They can't do it.
I think, unfortunately, the answer is not a great deal. What I just did was to Google the word ferroresonance, and there are a lot of websites that talk about it. When an unloaded three-phase system develops it, apparently some terrible things can happen. I'm getting that impression. But I have not encountered it. There are various kinds of ways that a magnetic circuit can become nonlinear when saturation occurs. And I'm not sure that's what we're talking about here. As I said, I'm looking at some of these other websites. There are voltage regulators that use ferroresonance. I think it's used in some of these so-called constant voltage transformers. I know I've owned a transformer-like device which has a resonant primary circuit with a great big oil-filled capacitor added to it. And over a certain range of load currents that you can put on the secondary winding, the transformer will give you nearly constant voltage out of the secondary, regardless of the primary voltage from the local or con ed, going from, say, 90 volts to 140 volts. So there's a kind of ferroresonance transformer which becomes a extremely effective constant voltage output device, almost an automatic voltage regulator. I've owned one of those, and the only slight disadvantage they have is that the output waveform that you get on the secondary is not a pure sine wave. It's a slightly flat-topped sine wave. So among the people who are listening tonight who may have some experience or further knowledge about ferroresonance, because I'm sorry to say I don't have much, please give me your call letters right now. KQRIW.
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel. Check in.
Okay, I heard someone say check in. Who is the person who said check in, and do you have knowledge on ferroresonance?
Yes, KB2, VBN. No knowledge on ferroresonance. I just have a question for you.
Okay, we're going to add you to the list because we take the questioners in order, unless it's already on this particular subject and you said it was not on this subject. Is there anyone within the sound of Marilyn Dick's voice who has specific experience, knowledge, or whatever on the subject of ferro resonance? That's the subject that's being discussed right now. If you know something about ferro resonance, even how to spell it, give us your call. That is right now, K2RIW. Yeah, I wonder if you've had a chance, Wesley, to do a web search on any one of your search engines on the word ferroresonance. When I did a web search, when I used ferroresonance in Wikipedia, I got 15,000 results. Not all of them are Wikipedia, but it looks to me like there is a lot of web information. And when you did that web search, I wonder if any of that material helped in your understanding of this. And I think I've had the impression that you may have already encountered the condition with some of the experiments you've already been doing. Give us a few more words on that, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. N2XJN. Ferroresonance occurs when you have unloaded three phase systems consisting of an inductance and capacitive components, and this one is interrupted by the single phase means. In practice, this is a typical high voltage electrical distribution network of the transformers, inductive component, and power cables, capacitive component. If such network has no load, that applied to the voltage is then interrupted on the single phase, the ferro resonance may be observed. In the remaining phases, if the remaining phases are not interrupted, and that phenomenon that ferro resonance continues, over voltage can lead to breakdown of insulation and connected components, and of course result the failure of the components. The reason that I decided to pick up that subject is that one very significant factor, let's say you have a 50 hertz or 60 hertz, you may see a peak that is wide of approximately from 50 hertz to 150 hertz, and this peak could go up to 100 times of the voltage delivered. And that's what was observed in 1907 by Tesla. And that's why he actually decided to further explore this area, and he came out with the patent for free energy devices. well, he never claimed that this voltage comes from nothing. When I spoke to Eric and I spoke to Glenn, I've got an impression, and these guys are pretty knowledgeable in this area. I caught them by surprise, and I asked them the question, and they were able to give me a lot of information about it. What actually is happening is that if you have a conductive, if you have the capacitance and you have the inductance, then you actually create parallel or serious resonance circuit. Now, of course, their claim was that this power is not coming from nothing. You gotta pay for it. You get it from the grid. But yes, it does occur, and it creates a lot of problems. People were trying actually to avoid that. What I'm trying to do is learn how to make that, and it's also present in one single phase delivery circuit. Back to you, Dick, and to Andrea.
WB2HWW, with a common favorite resident power supply stick.
How we recognized, and I think I also heard somebody on the internet trying to check in. Is there another person trying to check in? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
With me, K2KEY.
Mel recognized, and I think there was another person trying to sign in from the internet. Who is the internet person? Maybe not. Okay, we're going to pick up Howie and Mel in that order. Go ahead, Howie.
Not going to stay long. I'll give it to Mel. The only thing I know about Ferret Resident Supply, they use them in repeaters or in commercial equipment. Motorola and GE uses them. They basically are a Ferret Resident transformer. Where I think on a primary, not the primary, the secondary, they have a resonant circuit with a capacitor across the coil, and they have a full-wave rectifier. What it basically allows you to do, but they do have one problem, is that their resonant supplies generate a lot of magnetic fields, so if you have any audio equipment around, you got to keep it far away. You got to keep the power supply a distance away from the rest of the equipment in the cabinet, or it will create an AC hum. They do generate a lot of heat. They are very basic. They don't use any solid-state regulation, but they can keep the output voltage within a volt or so, about a volt. And if you can go from no load to full load, they'd only see around 15 or 16 volt swing. They're used in, like, Micor base stations or Master 2 repeaters. I never liked them. I used to use regular solid-state linear supplies, but I've used the pair of resident supply stick, and they're very well. They're very reliable. Back to you, K2RIW, WB2HW. I don't know about the other thing that is being discussed, but I do know what pair of resident supplies are used for in commercial systems.
Yeah, I'm going to go along with you when it comes to that ferro-resonant constant voltage transformer. I think it was the 150-watt class that I owned. It did produce a pretty loud hum, some pretty strong magnetic field, a fair amount of heat, but it did do a rather good job of maintaining constant output voltage as a function of change in the line voltage going into it. So it had some advantages, not ideal, but in certain circumstances, some people like them. I wonder what your experience is with them, Mel. How often have you used them? Did you also hear some hum, see some heat, and get recognize a rather strong magnetic field from the one that you used? K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
This is K2KEY. Well, I was going to ask, is this akin to the experiments that were done, like with Faraday, with ferromagnetics? Is this associated with the same experiment, Dick? Over.
I'm not sure, Mel, but why don't you give us a couple of words about what Faraday did with what you believe is ferromagnetics. Go ahead.
Well, I'm going to go back to my physics, studying physics, and Faraday was one of my favorites because, you know, well, basically the association with electronics eventually, something he did way before we knew much about radio, but still carries a very worthwhile part of his name involved in radio communications. And he divided, basically, he did experiments in dividing materials into different magnetic, lines of magnetic forces of something. Oh, my God, let me think if I can get the right words out. Intensity of ferromagnetics, strong magnetic magnetized materials like iron and all, and how they behaved, and I know he divided it up into different degrees of magnetics and lines of force and dynamic, diametric. I know that's what they did. Let me let it drop. The application eventually was, I believe, how they classified compass of the compass needle that I know they refer to it as compass needles in various degrees of ferromagnetic stick. I can't get the right words out because I'm trying to, you know, recall all this info over.
I'm racking my brain, and I do remember back in approximately 1986, when at Airborne Instruments Laboratory, me and a bunch of other guys were working on the encoder line replaceable unit. Encoder? Yes, it was the encoder LRU, encoder line replaceable unit on the B-1 bomber program. It had a three-phase transformer that ran into a very healthy 5-volt regulated power supply that had the capability of producing 150 amperes of output at 5 volts. It was running a large amount of T-squared L logic in that particular box. This was a $500,000 box that probably weighed about 85 pounds. Had great big handles on the front. It's one of the removable assemblies on that particular aircraft. And I do remember on a couple of occasions the three-phase, 400-cycle, what was it now, half-kilowatt transformer would go into something that got called ferroresonance, where it would go into an extremely loud hum, and the power supply would behave in very erratic ways. So apparently, if you don't do a real good job of designing a three-phase power supply for all possible load conditions, you can run into this condition called ferroresonance, in which you get the wild amounts of primary current, saturating sounds out of the transformer, improper voltages, and so on. And I don't remember what the solution was, but I do know it was a problem that was encountered on a couple of occasions. Now, let me drop for a second. Where you're doing research on rotary magnetic machines, among other things, using neodymium very strong magnets, and where strong magnetic fields are going to be exposed to iron-like materials. I guess one of the things you're possibly going to be investigating, Wesley, is whether or not ferroresonance can be used as a desirable technique for getting excess energy out of a rotary magnetic machine. I'm going to make a guess as to what there could be a possible connection there. And maybe that's part of your investigation. So far, it looks like you've almost stumped the crew assembled tonight. We don't seem to have a great deal of knowledge as to what is and how you control and how do you use usefully ferroresonance. Drag your feet a little bit in case anyone else on frequency or on the internet wants to sign in and tell us what they know about ferroresonance. So I'm going to pass it back to you, Wesley. Drag your feet, listen to see if there's anyone else, and if there's not, then pick up. And 2XJN with a little delay. Anyone else who's got knowledge on this subject, give us your call letters right now. K2RYW in the TechNet.
K2KY, just thought of something.
Bell recognized. Let's see if there's anyone else. Looks like there isn't. Go right ahead and tell us what you just remembered, Mel.
Now, I remember reading directly that not only Faraday did some experimental work, but was later continued by Maxwell, ferromagnetics and resonance circuits. Maxwell, I remember directly, had a thing called the dynamic theory of electromagnetic and ferromagnetic fields. That maybe you can look that up and see the experiments that they were doing. I don't know. But in the back of my mind, something says to me that Albert Einstein also did some kind of research into these theories. Over.
Yeah, with names like that, and with the great research capability we've got with the internet these days, using various search engines and various search word combinations, I can tell there's a lot written on the subject. I mean, I did a very simple search and got what they think is 130,000 answers. So I wonder what you've been able to find on the internet so far, Wesley. And do you believe that some of the phenomena on the rotary machines, which apparently are producing some excess energy, are you suspicious that ferroresonance could be one of the ingredients of what they're seeing? N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Well, actually, I start from Tesla, and from the information that were actually coming from Russia. I know that the former Soviet government and KGB were very strictly treating all of the information about the ferromagnetism, and nearby the Moscow they built the base where they were researching it for the years, but it was the communist time. So far what I was able to find about that is that the ferroresonance has four types: the fundamental mode, the subharmonic mode, the quasi-period mode, and the chaotic mode, which the ferroresonance could be identified by either the spectrum of the current and voltage signals or by stroboscopic image obtained by measuring current and the voltage at a given point of the system and plotting it by instantaneous values and instants separated by the system period. That's what I've got from the internet. Let me drop. When you take the spectrum analyzing picture of that, then what you see is actually the peak that is averaging up to 100 times. Mostly it's 19, 20 times, but you can get up to 100 times with the width of 150 hertz. And then, all of a sudden, you have a harmonics, and the harmonics are usually about one half of the previous one. So, let's say the first one is 100%, then you have 50% of it, then you have 50% of the primary harmonic. And that's being called the fundamental mode. The subharmonic mode, the signals are periodic with the period, which multiply at the source. I don't know how to explain it. I don't have enough English. It was in Polish. What actually being taught is that when you take that signal, you not necessarily pay for it. Is that many people found that the power meters are absolutely ignorant to the presence of that resonance. That means you get it, you actually in that particular peak getting many times more of the power, but the power meter does not even show slight signs of it. Back to you, Antoine.
Yeah, I'm a little bit worried by that one. First of all, when it comes to a watt-hour meter or other kinds of power meters, there's many ways of building one. A naive person would have some kind of instrumentation which looks at voltage, another kind of instrumentation that looks at current, and then some kind of an algorithm that multiplies them together to try to come up with power. The watt-hour meter that exists outside of your house, supplied by Con Ed, is really a true RMS power meter in that it instantaneously, millisecond by millisecond, looks at the combination of voltage and current with the phase angle between the two and really calculates the real amount of resistive power that your house is consuming, and that's what you pay for. So what I'm getting at is that under normal circumstances, it's quite difficult to fool a properly designed instantaneous watt-hour meter. If subharmonic energy and harmonic energy was present, because by millisecond, degree by degree of the 60-cycle sine wave going into it, for each degree of voltage and each degree of current, it is multiplying the two together. The disc rotates, in the case of the old mechanical one, the disc rotates only proportional to the true resistive power you've consumed, and it's somewhat immune, and it ignores reactive power. Let me drop for a second. So the right kind of a watt-hour meter, I think, might not be fooled for reasonable frequency regions, And yes, when you get a chaotic behavior of a nonlinear magnetic circuit, you can be producing all kinds of harmonics and subharmonics, and it can be going through a chaotic behavior that is almost non-repetitive. I remember reading some stories about that. But I still think the right kind of a watt-hour meter is capable of telling you the truth of what's going on. I'm going to go now to the next person on the list, which was Jeff. And then after that, we'll go to Rich. I think it is the third person on our list. After that, we've got Freddie, which I think is the fourth person on our list. And then with the time left over, we'll come back. But we will be also taking a break at 9 o'clock for Mel's mailbag. Jeff, WA2 Romeo Alpha Sierra, what would you like to ask the TechNet tonight? K2RIW and the TechNet. You got it, Jeff.
Okay. Thank you, Dick. K2RIW and the TechNet. WA2RAS. I have a situation, and I'm not sure how common it is. What I've got is telephone interference. I don't mean that my transmissions are interfering with phone lines. That does happen. I'm talking about the other way around. In other words, I have a phone, in the shack, and when a phone call comes in, it's creating interference for me. What I've done is remove the phone, which was kind of a drastic measure. My question is, how common is this, and is there an easy solution? K2RIW, WA2 Romeo Alpha Sierra.
I've heard some things like this before, Jeff. One very key piece of information you haven't told us yet is that when the telephone is receiving a call or when the telephone is in the active mode and you're receiving interference, presumably on a ham band, you didn't tell us which band or how much. Is it affecting 80 meters? Is it affecting 10 meters? Is it affecting 2 meters? And how much S-meter deflection did you get? What are the characteristics do you know? In other words, if it was a 2-meter antenna and you can aim it in different directions, did it make a difference? When you talk and pick up the phone or just when it's ringing, what brand of phone was it also? And some of the more modern phones with their digital techniques, particularly if it's a wireless phone, you didn't tell us if it's a wired or a wireless phone. So we're missing about 4 pieces of information there, Jeff. Tell us anything. WA2RAS, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I hope I don't forget all the questions. WA2RAS. Okay, it was definitely happening on 80 and 40 meters. It was a hard line. It was not a wireless phone. The phone was a Radio Shack phone. The interference would occur when a phone call was received. In other words, when the phone was ringing, it would cause significant interference. I mean, there'd be tremendous QR Nancy, and you could hear the a big pulsing sound come through. You know, I don't want to over dramatize this, but it was it made reception pretty much impossible while the phone was ringing. The distance between the phone and the receiver was approximately 6 feet. Did I fill in all the blanks? K2RAW, W2RAS.
Yeah, Jeff, you gave us a lot of good information there. So Radio Shack, I think you said 6 feet, 80 and 40 meters, and when the telephone was ringing. When the telephone was picked up and it's no longer ringing, and you're now making a phone call, did the interference persist, Jeff? Back to you, Jeff.
Is that a cordless phone, Jeff?
Oh, it's a wired phone is what he said, Barry. Jeff, when you picked up and now you're carrying on the phone call, did the interference persist or is it only when the phone was ringing? To B2RAS, K2RAW in the TechNet.
This is WA2RAS. I'm not 100% sure. My instinct, but my recollection was that the interference was only when the phone was ringing, not when the phone had been, not when the ringing stopped. In other words, I don't believe the interference continued when the receiver was off the hook. It was like having an electric fence in the shack with me. You know, it just very significant pulsing type of QRN. Back to you, Dick.
Comment and to exit.
And why do it? Ringing voltage.
Wesley and NY2H both recognized. Tell me what the ringing sounded like. In other words, was it a real bell-type ringing, a mechanical device that was the ring of the phone, or do you believe it was an electronic-like sound? What did the phone sound like when it rang? Back to you, Jim.
Are you talking about the actual sound of the ring, or are you talking about what was coming over my receiver? Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, it's a good question. I didn't make that clear. The acoustic sound that your ears heard coming from the wired Radio Shack telephone while it's ringing. Assume now that your ham radio loudspeaker was turned off. What did it sound like? Was it a mechanical bell-like sound like you used to have on an old-fashioned Ma Bell telephone? Or was it an electronic sound that the telephone itself acoustically made when it was ringing? Back to you, Jeff.
That's a very good question. As I recall, Dick, it was kind of an unnatural sound, an unnatural ring. It was not the definitive type of the phone ring that one would associate. It was more of an electronic type of sound, if that makes any sense. It wasn't a normal, ring, as I recall, Dick. Go ahead.
No spark.
Was it 2 seconds on, 4 seconds off?
Yeah, the actual ring in the old days of a wired Ma Bell telephone used to be a 90-volt signal at a 20 hertz rate, a 90-volt sine wave.
480 hertz, and it's 120 volts.
Okay, I was told it was a 20 hertz, 90-volt wave that went to a magnetic circuit that moved a clacker back and forth magnetically that hit between two individual bells that had two slightly different tones to them, and that's what gave you the characteristic ring. I was also about to guess that there was some form of interrupter, like a doorbell transformer of the old days. It was a magnetic circuit with a set of point contacts to it that became intermittently interrupted, and then the inductive kickback of that circuit could make some real nice spark gap transmissions. You solved the problem by moving the Radio Shack a far distance away. I suspect that ringer circuit could have been modified to stop it from doing that. Now, both Wesley and Harry, in that order, are going to tell us their information on this one. Wesley first, N2XJN, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, for the system manufactured before 1974, that was the 480 hertz, and that was 120 volts. And then the tone was moved to 400 hertz or 500 hertz. That would actually was the regulation at that time. Now, as far as the interference when it's coming, let me drop. Okay. From that, what the gentleman says is there is no mechanical device that was employed because it was more like electronic tone. But you got to understand, when you have a ring, you have 120 volts. Now, it is going physically to the telephone, and you have a 440 hertz. Now, look at the harmonic of that, and look at the power of that. What you have is actually, you have a transformer. When it comes to the coil or any kind of device that may actually resonate, it will resonate. Correct me if I'm wrong, and to exchange.
WA2VDH with a comment.
VDH recognized, and there's two people ahead of you, V2VDH. Let's see. Okay, there's some difference as to what is the exact voltage and frequency that the ringing circuit used to have and has nowadays on a wired telephone. And so I still think, though, that since I am guessing, Jeff, that you only had these blasts of noise in your ham radio while your particular phone was ringing, and when the phone was picked up, I am guessing it didn't make the interference. Therefore, that ringing circuit could have been modified if you wanted to. A simple solution is to go out and buy another telephone. They're not that expensive these days. But for a guy who's got a scientific interest and wants to dig into the problem, it might be kind of fun to investigate how the ringing circuit can do that and could it be modified. NY2H, I bet you you've got some comments on this one. I think it's Lewis. Go ahead, Lou. What would you do in a case like that? Sorry, I called you Harry before. NY2H, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Okay, very good. Now, I don't know if they changed the system or not, but you're right about those systems. Very much when you get a shock. I can say now, I don't know if they changed that. Now, I'm curious as to whether he's got a positional, top of pair, or is he actually getting off of a modem, like a cable modem. And I'm also curious if this thing uses those voltages anymore, even just for signaling, because as Wesley said, for a while at least, it would still go to the phone, but then the phone might have its own little electronic tone or something to more use for signaling. But in the old days, yeah, they wanted that energy, move that bell, ring the bell there. But that's it. I'm just thinking, and that was on 2 seconds and off 4 seconds. That was the ring cycle. That's why I asked the question. So if his interference is on that basis, then that would say that that's what it was. But I guess I'm not even certain if they still use the same methodology or not, but it was 4 on and 4 off, and that was your ringing.
K2KY comments.
That's good to know, Lou. 2 on and 4 off.
K2YO.
And K2YO also recognized. We'll get to you in a minute, Bernie. But John's the next person who signed it. W2VDH. Go right ahead, John. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, fine business. Yeah, I just wanted to mention the ringing voltage, as I remember it, and I'm pretty sure it still is, was about 90, 100 volts, 20 cycle, basically a square wave. I think what you're referring to, Wesley, the 480 hertz, that's audible ringing. Nowadays, with the ESS, to avoid some of the fraud problems, what they do is they send power ringing to the phone, which is the 120 volts or so, 20 cycle square wave, and sent back to the calling party is audible ringing, which is that 480 hertz that gives that nice pleasant sound of phone ringing. Back in the days of crossbar offices, they used to be able to cut directly through That is, you were actually connected to the ringing phone. So there was some fraud problems that came up in that, but that's another story. Anyway, back to Ned.
John, am I correct in assuming that you used to work for Ma Bell, and therefore you were directly concerned with some of these issues? Back to you, John.
Back in the 70s, I was at Bell Labs, Naperville. Go ahead.
Fascinating. Okay, Wesley recognized. You were at Bell Labs. Which facility did you say, John?
That was at Naperville. I was working on the number 4 ESS.
Okay. Out of curiosity, ESS stands for?
Electronic Switching Systems. The 4 ESS was a toll switching office. First one went into South Canal Street in Chicago. Go ahead.
Sounds like fascinating work. Okay, the next person on the list was Mel, K2KUY. Go right ahead, Mel, with your comment.
I was just going to confirm that everybody just basically said the same thing as I was going to say. It was a 20 hertz system. In fact, when they were tearing them out, we did a lot of work for the subcontractor for the telephone company for their system. And did just about, I think, every one of them in the New York area, we did the subcontract work there. And when they were ripping out the system, the old system was a mechanical system. It used a motor generator to generate the 20 hertz. Each rack had one of these motor generators sitting on the bottom there, nice gray-looking thing with a motor, very well made with bearings and all, and I saw it, they were throwing them out and all, so I took one. I think I still have it. How could you part with such a magnificent many piece of mechanics? But that's exactly what it was. Let me let it drop, and I'll tell you a funny thing else with it.
And when you do, also tell us, with the valuable pieces of equipment that you've collected over the years, have you ever considered making a museum on Dover Street? Back to you, Mel.
I have a partial museum that started there with some very unusual things in radio communications, and even before that, my oldest piece I have is an 1847 sounder that possibly even may have been belonged to Morse, but the whole story about it was used during the Civil War to send the first of the communications because of the use of communications between Washington and the Army in the field. It was the first time radio, actually not radio, but direct communications went back and forth, so I happen to have one of their pieces of equipment that was used. But that's beside the point. Let me let it drop, and I'll say one more word about the phone company. Okay, anyhow, the ring generator, like I say, each one of them sat at the bottom of the rack, and they were beautifully mechanical pieces of equipment. And, of course, that was all dumped to put in the electronic system. But you were right. It generated 90 volts at 20 hertz. In fact, I used to know a guy that was in the service business, and he was fixing telephone answering machines. And he was going crazy. He says, gee, you know, I got to keep ringing another line. I have to test them just to see if it'll pick up and all. So I let him borrow that ring generator stick that he used it for quite a while to generate his own ringing system for repairing the early days, the telephone answering machines, which were unique because Ma Bell didn't let you connect to the line. They had this mechanical gadget for a telephone pickup machine, which fit underneath the receiver. And when it rang, the solenoid there actually picked the receiver up after a couple of rings, and then it had a mic and an earpiece right underneath the receiver. And that played the one recording, which was the announcement, and then it switched over to another tape. And this was all real-for-real tape, and picked up the message, over.
Comment. Wow. Wesley recognized. We're going to go down the list in order. Bernie was the next person who signed it. Bernie, tell us what you know about the telephone ringing circuit. And by the way, where John told us it is a 20 hertz, 90 volt square wave, and Mel told us it is a motor generator set that was making that voltage, which I think would be a little closer to sine wave, and maybe you know. K2 Yankee Oscar. K2 RIW, you got it, Bernie.
Good evening, Dick Mellon, the net. My experience has been on the CPE side, which is the customer-provided equipment, both for manufacturers and on the interconnect side. I still do interconnect work now. And we used to design to a spec of the ringing voltage was 320 volts peak-to-peak, and the frequency, I believe, used to design to 30 hertz, and I don't remember why it was 30 instead of 20. Back in the 80s, you had to deal with issues of ringer equivalence. I remember an old Bell telephone, a 2500 set, had a ringer equivalence of it would pull about 10 milliamps on AC. And nowadays, most phones, if you look at your phone today, it probably has a ringer equivalence down near zero because people are using high impedance detectors. They don't really use that power anymore to actually move a mechanical circuit anymore. They just detect it and then generate their own ring. Also, that 320 volts peak-to-peak, the stuff that I worked with, it was definitely sinusoidal. The last time I looked at it with an oscilloscope was probably 5 or 6 years ago, and it was definitely sinusoidal, and it's offset at negative 48 volts with the talk battery. I would suspect the gentleman that was having QRM, I concur with all of you that it was the telephone, because the phone line is still there, and when that phone line rings, it still has that power on it. But if the unconnected phone line is not causing him a problem, then I would have to assume it was coming out of his telephone. Just my thoughts here.
Very fine. And I just did a quick calculation and came to the conclusion that 320 volts peak-to-peak happens to be 113 volts of RMS. So is it 19 or 113? Doesn't really matter. But it looks like 20 hertz and maybe sinusoidal, or nearly sinusoidal, was the actual ring voltage. In the old days, it supplied the power to mechanically move a relay-like device, which moved a mechanical clacker back and forth, which struck two separate bells that were side by side on slightly different tones, and that gave the characteristic mechanical sound of a ringing Ma Bell telephone way back in the Dark Ages. And I remember seeing some of those, and it was a capacitively coupled circuit, so that the 20 hertz sine wave went to that magnetic circuit and rang the phone, and yet the circuit didn't sit there as a drain on the actual telephone conversation because it was capacitively coupled, and now the 20 volts or whatever it is that operated in the old days, your pull-down voltage to operate the carbon microphone, that wasn't being loaded down by the mechanical electronic ringer circuit. Okay, telephone's the front. So as you can see, Jeff, I'm reasonably sure you can modify that phone if you desire to do so, as opposed to just going and buying another one. Wesley's going to give us some more information about his experience with telephones. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Wesley.
Okay, I was analyzing N2XJN. I was analyzing this voltage. It was a long time ago, and I came to the conclusion that the 120 volts, when the ring was with no telephone connected, actually dropped to approximately 113. In some instances, it goes below 100. It was never 90 volts. Probably because the telephone company estimated that at the end of the wire, that's supposed to be a drop of the voltage, and the ringer still should be responding. That's one of the comments. And the second of the comments is that, yes, I was talking about the frequency of the ringer in terms of the audible one. And the reason for that was that gentleman said that he did not have a sound of the mechanical device, but he had a sound of something like electronically created sound. So that was the regulation at that time. And that was what I can recall. Back to the Gantor Chair.
I'm guessing 20 hertz was chosen so that if by mistake, while the phone is off the hook and you've got the earpiece against your head, of 20 hertz was coming through, it was essentially subaudible, and therefore wouldn't be a blast of a very loud signal, a 100 and some odd volt signal into your ear. 20 hertz of a quasi-sine wave wouldn't be an unpleasant sound. That, and it supplied in the old days, the 100 and some odd volt 20 hertz sine wave on the telephone line was connected to your particular twisted pair, and it really supplied the power that moved the electromechanical circuit that created the mechanical ringing of the clacking of two separate bells. And nowadays, in those days, the load on the line really was your magnetic relay-like device, and because of line drop, depending on how far you were from the central station, maybe you got as little as 90 volts, and maybe you got as much as 120, something in that vicinity. Nowadays, most telephones provide no real load to the ringing circuit. Therefore, that ringing circuit runs unloaded, and we probably see higher voltages. I think the bottom line of all this, Jeff, as I see it, is that we've almost figured out something about where that blast of radio noise on 80 and 40 meters on your wired phone from Radio Shack is coming from. And if you wanted to investigate it, I'm reasonably sure it would be an interesting science experiment, if you wanted to find out how it's doing it and how to stop it from doing that. Before we pass it back to Jeff, who asked the original question, anyone else want us to tell us their experience with telephones? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment W2RS.
Mr. RA2RSO. RAS and RSO in that order. Mr. RAS, go ahead, Jeff.
Okay. First of all, as I recall, the sound of the ringer was... it was something like this. That was the sound. It was almost like a pulse as opposed to a ring. The other thing is, what I did to stop it, well, all I did was, as one of the other people on the net mentioned, I disconnect the wire from the jack to the phone. So the wire is still there, but is no longer causing interference. Obviously, this is one of, I must have maybe, I don't know, five phones in the house on the same line. And this is, there are other phones in the house, and the wire is still there, but it is no longer causing interference because because it's not ringing anymore. And my big question is, one of my big questions is, this was the really significant interference. I mean, severe interference. You couldn't hear anything. The QRN was so bad while this thing was ringing. My question is this common? I've never heard of it, but that could be just me. Back to Ned.
Yeah, by the kind of responses we've gotten tonight, Jeff, I think your situation is somewhat unique. We haven't had a whole bunch of people saying it. Yes, I ran into that too. So far, you're the first. Let's see what Frank's got to say about this. N2RSO, K2RIW and TechNet. You got it, Frank.
K2RIW, here is N2RSO. Vic, back in the early 60s, before the Army grabbed me, I was an installer for Western Electric, and I installed number 5 crossbar and ANI, which is automatic number identification, in many, if not all, of the central offices in Brooklyn. And to the best of my recollection, the phone system then worked on 48 volts DC, and the ringing voltage was, as you originally said, 90 volts AC. So unless they changed it, that's it. Not 120, not 113, but 90 volts AC. Back to Ned and to RSO.
And Frank, since you were doing customer
customer end of the line, it is my guess that you are most of the time experiencing 90 volts of delivered voltage under load of a telephone ringer circuit. I'm going to pass it back to you for a confirmation on that. And because of the line drop, quite possibly higher voltages were really being issued by the central office itself. Also, because you live in Wantagh, and a good friend of mine who's heavy into amateur television also lives in Wantagh, Mike Chirillo, W2OTA, I wonder if you and Mike have ever crossed paths since you both live in the same town. N2RSO, K2RIW, the Tech Net. You got it, Frank.
Okay, Dick. yes, Mike is one of my neighbors. Matter of fact, he was good friends with my next door neighbor who, before passing on, was one of the leaders of the Boy Scouts. And Mike and I believe his wife were both involved with scouting. And my first experience with Mike was when I was when I connected my my cable box to the antenna instead of the cable, and I picked up Mike in his basement video on I don't recall the channel, but it was I believe it was 434 megacycles. I had to go to somewhere on 2 meters to pick up the audio, but matter of fact, I've been trying to get Mike to come over to the Wantagh Radio Club to put on a demonstration, but he says it's too involved. He's got too much equipment. Let me drop it for a second. And back to your original question. No, I was not involved with customer service. I was inside the central offices, sitting on an extension of a ladder and doing wire-up connections of the automatic number identification circuits and observing the phone numbers coming up on the gas-filled cold cathode lamps called Nixie lamps, manufactured by Burroughs. I'm sure you're familiar with those. And no, I had no contact at all with the consumers. It was strictly wiring thousands of connections a day. Got to be boring after a while. Back then, that N2RSO.
Very fine, Frank. Sounds like a fascinating job. You were looking at the identification of the phone numbers coming up. I'm kind of curious why that was required, Frank. Go ahead.
Yeah, we that was in order to test the circuitry after we installed the panels for the ANI, automatic number identification. We wanted to be sure that the numbers were being identified properly, and the whole purpose of this was for billing. Was able to go into a computer and prepare the billing records for the consumer. But I was fascinated by those Nixie lamps. In fact, I started a project on one job. When we finished the job, they had quite a number of parts left over, and it was the policy of the supervisors to let the personnel take whatever they wanted, the reason being that they were afraid of being questioned by the engineers as to why there were so many parts left over. And I had a few Nixie lamps and some stepping relays. I was going to build a clock, and then I'm not sure whether it was Radio Shack or somebody, Lafayette, came out with an electronic clock, and that killed everything. Okay, back to you, N2RSO.
Very fine, Frank. Sounds like you had some real fun with electronics in those days. So, Jeff, I think we've reasonably pinned down that your situation is unique. There's something about that particular phone that may be an error in that ringing circuit. And by replacing that ringing circuit in that phone, if you wanted to open it up and do that, or to investigate how it's making the noise, but somehow
the 90-like voltage, 20-hertz-like ringing signal coming down your twisted pair to your particular wired Radio Shack phone is exciting that circuit in some kind of a discontinuous manner where it's doing spark gapping, the sparking and arcing, so to speak, and that's my guess as to how it's making broadband noise that probably has no particular frequency favor to it. If the phone is close enough to your antenna or close enough to a piece of random wire coming out of your ham radio receiver, I'll bet you you're going to hear that noise on 80, 40, 20, 15, 10, 6 meters, 2 meters, and so on. It probably gets weaker as it goes up in frequency, but I'll bet you it's there because of some kind of an arcing and sparking. So on a final there, Jeff, do you intend to do any further digging into that particular phone, or because you've disconnected that ringing circuit and it's no longer doing it, the problem's gone away, and maybe you go on to bigger and better things? W-A-2-R-A-S, K-2-L-I-W in the tech man.
No, I appreciate all the all the comments. I think I, you know, have a much better understanding of what went on here. I had only really used that receiver on 80 and 40, but I'm sure, you know, as you say, had I, you know, used the receiver on higher frequencies, I'm sure the results would have been the same. And since just disconnecting the this particular phone, you know, to solve the problem, you know, as I said, I you know, I have many other phones on the same line, and there's no shortage of phone communication. It's just that why this received, yeah, it just wasn't, it's not worth the trouble to for me to make this receiver phone receiver usable. But I appreciate all the comments. K2RAW, this is WA2RAS.
Very fine, Jim. Mel, we're a little bit beyond 9 o'clock, so go right ahead over to your mailbag. K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, K2RAW in the tech mat.
Hey, very interesting. Yeah, this is bringing back Nixie 2. I sort of smiled at that because I did also take a batch of them and wound up making a very nice frequency counter. Pretty big piece of equipment, but eventually gave it to the ham club, which sold it at in fact, that's Limark, one of Limark's handsets. Anyhow, let's see. Yeah, I picked out a few. All right, so I'll make it brief here so that we can continue on, and then I'm just looking for ones that are very popular. You know, let me let it drop for a second, and I'll read this one.
And Mel, are you running full power? A little bit of noise in the background. Good enough, but if you had a little more steam, your voice would sound a little clearer. And you can talk a little bit closer to the microphone. Over to you, Mel.
Okay. I kicked it up to 55 watts now. How does that sound?
Almost dead full quieting, and your voice is nice and loud. Boy, can we hear you well. Go right ahead, Mel.
Okay. I've had this set for another repeater where they tell me I'm too loud. you can go crazy. You've got to keep changing settings. But all right. Anyhow, here's one. You know, apropos to this whole discussion that we had for weeks on verticals and how to experiment and all, the question seems to come up here a number of times for some reason, whether or not we didn't make it clear or not. How does the diameter of a vertical, the vertical portion of it, how does the vertical radiator, how does the diameter have any effect on the operation of a vertical, Vic? Does it or doesn't it have a reasonable kind of effect? Over.
The answer would have to be yes. Diameter always has an effect. However, how much? If I go from a vertical piece of wire that's made out of 14-gauge household wire, that's about the skinniest you and I would ever use on a vertical antenna for 80, 40, or 20 meters where we're suspending it from a tree or a tower or whatever. That's about the skinniest we would go. And about the fattest we would go to build a so-called caged dipole, which consists of a whole lot of vertical wires with some kind of a spreader mechanism so that the wires constitute the perimeter of a cylinder. If you cut a cross-section through it, you'd see the wires at 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, if you use 12 wires, so to speak. And it would make a cylinder, and you could make that cylinder 4 inches in diameter if you wanted to, which is still, at those frequencies, an extremely small fraction of a wavelength. Let me drop. And you could get an exact quantitative answer to that question by going to the so-called Brown and Woodward curves that are in every single issue of the Antenna Engineering Handbook, Chapter 4 on every issue except the first issue, of course, Chapter 3, where Brown and Woodward, way back in 1947, did a man-year of work in which they built a zillion monopole antennas on a great big ground plane, and they chose every reasonable diameter of radiator and every reasonable length of radiator and plotted the impedance, the resistive component and the reactive component. It's all there. So even if a guy doesn't have access to the radio amateur's handbook, the antenna engineering handbook, which is a $140 book if you buy it brand new, and maybe because it's a little bit high in technology, maybe your local library doesn't have it. But you can get a copy of those two curves by going to the website of Whiskey Alpha 1, Mike Bravo Alpha, .org, or is it .net, but I think it's .org. And that's Tom Williams' website. And at the bottom of the website, you'll see the so-called dipole matching information by K2RIW, and there's the curves. So you can get an exact answer by going to those curves. And very similar to what you discussed last week, let me drop. Those curves are not, the vertical axis is ohms of resistance on one curve, and the vertical axis is ohms of reactance on the other curve. And the horizontal axis is in degrees, which you discussed last week, where 90 degrees represents a quarter wavelength, and 180 degrees represents half wavelength. So by plotting it in degrees, which is a left-handed way of plotting it in wavelengths, the curves now are independent of frequency. You could use that set of curves if you were building a monopole, a vertical radiator, and if you were building it on 70 centimeters, or if you're building it on 80 meters, the exact same curves will give you the right answer if you make things in proportion. So that's one way of getting at an answer. As you go from a very skinny wire to a fatter wire, the resistive component changes very slowly. The reactive component changes a little bit more rapidly, but around the quarter wavelength region, it sort of pivots in that area and again changes rather slowly. But the exact change versus length and diameter, it's in those curves. That's a quantitative answer. And because you're changing in wavelengths rather slowly, because quite often many of those wires are 1/100th of a wavelength in diameter. And so when you go from 1/100th of a wavelength to 1/200th of a wavelength, you're changing rather slowly in these phenomena most of the time. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Question.
Go ahead, Wesley.
I have a question. You say you were talking about the diameter of the material being used. How about the material by itself? How it differs when you use different materials? You could use aluminum, you could use steel, you could use any other material. That's what I'm actually interested with. Back to you.
Yeah, that's a fairly good question, Wesley. For most of the diameters you're likely to use on HF frequencies, the average guy is not stringing a vertical piece of wire. He should be, but he's not. He wants it to be self-supporting. Therefore, if he's making it out of aluminum tubing, he's probably making it a minimum of inch and a quarter.